What is the situation of health and well-being in Europe? In this episode, Tobias Silberzahn from McKinsey and I are talking about biohacking 101, habits that make a difference, digital health ecosystems, and much, much more.
The factor behind the success of Asian digital health ecosystems, the three key success factors are convenience, convenience, and convenience, to make it the citizens as easy as possible to look after their health and well-being. You know, two-thirds of the improvement opportunity really lies in the areas of health promotion, prevention, health literacy, and healthier environment. That this would contribute $2.4 trillion to Europeans' GDP by 2040. So part of the ecosystem could be symptom checker or medication management app that helps me manage my disease. And when I feel bad or when something feels wrong, right, I can sort of engage with a very low barrier of, for me, one part, right, that people know more what drives their health and well-being, right? I didn't know that it was the pasta in. It's about small micro habits that you can integrate into your daily life.
Tobias Silberzahn is a trained biochemist and immunologist and works as a partner in McKinsey's Berlin office, where he is a member of the healthcare and innovation practice. The focus areas of his work are healthcare innovation, health tech business building, and digital transformation. Tobias leads the Global Health Tech Network, a community of over 1,500 health tech CEOs and founders, where he hosts the quarterly Health Tech CEO Roundtable. As part of his work, Tobias also hosts the MedTech R&D Industry Roundtable and publishes the eHealth Monitor Germany, an annual book about the digitization of the German health system. Within McKinsey, Tobias leads the health and well-being program for employees focused on sleep, nutrition, stress management, and fitness. The program was recently awarded the Brandon Hall HCM Excellence Award in Gold. McKinsey is a global management consulting firm committed to helping organizations accelerate sustainable and inclusive growth. McKinsey works with clients across the private, public, and social sector to solve complex problems and create positive change for all their stakeholders. It combines bold strategies and transformative technologies to help organizations innovate more sustainably, achieve lasting gains in performance, and build workforces that will thrive for this generation and the next. In this episode, we were talking about the European healthcare system, biohacking 101, the health tech startup ecosystem, small habits lead to big changes, and the four pillars of health and well-being. I hope you enjoy the show the same way as I did. Tobias, it's good to see you. How is life these days in Germany?
Good morning, Christian. Wonderful to see you again. And life in Germany, it's all sorts of topics going on, as you can imagine. The bigger picture in Europe with the war, the inflation, but also, you know, health and digitization of health is a topic, right? COVID is still a topic, and how do we want to live with this now as a society? So a lot's going on.
That's true. We are living in interesting times currently. I had a conversation recently with a friend from the United States. His name is Jonathan Sporn. He is the CEO of Gilgamesh Pharmaceuticals. And he's doing a lot of research in mental health and research and development. He has, I hope I get his age right. I think it's 5 decades of experience in developing, or 4 decades, solutions for that. And he brought up a point that I found very interesting, that he said he saw in the last few years, the last 3 years, 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, a surge in mental health issues. One of the investors he sold one of his previous companies to is Christian Angermeyer. And Christian Angermeyer posted recently an article on LinkedIn, or let's say a letter on LinkedIn, where he made the bold statement that 100% of the human population has mental health issues. And in this conversation, we tackled a lot about the situation in the United States, but not in Europe. And I'm very happy that you find some time today to come on this podcast and talk with me and the audience about the situation of health and well-being in Europe.
Very happy to. Thanks for having me.
Let me ask you the first question. What is the situation of health and well-being in Europe in your eyes currently?
Maybe I'll start with the mental health topic and that statement that you quoted. I'll now respond it from the angle of being a sort of a bit of a biohacker myself and also leading our health and well-being program within our German part of the company, right? And when we look at mental health from a workplace perspective, right, we actually see that there are sort of three different types of groups. One group is the group that is often very much in focus. That is the people that have really severe and acute needs that may require intense services and treatment, right? That is sort of one to two people usually in a 100 people in an organization. And then there is a second group that is about a quarter when we look into healthcare data. They require something that we could describe mental wellness support and moderate needs towards, you know, counseling, psychotherapy, et cetera. Right. And then there is a third group, and that's about then the remaining 75-ish employees. But they benefit from what I would now describe as support that fosters their mental well-being, right? So they are medically, you know, if they go to a doctor, right, they would not be diagnosed as having a condition, right? But they still would benefit from better mental health and well-being, right? And then when we now, you know, being originally a biochemist, looking at sort of the foundation, right, it makes sense because at the end of the day, in our daily lives, right, there are four or five things that are really impacting health and well-being and the person, and that is sleep, that is nutrition, that is mobility and fitness, that is stress management, and you know, for many people also then the topic of purpose, underlying motivation, social connections, of course, plays a big role, right? And if we just quickly look at the impact that sleep has on mental health, and then the impact that movement has on mental health, right? So if we do a little thought experiment and would say, I sleep too little, and I walk too little, right? Both of those things just biochemically have a negative impact on my mental health and well-being. So therefore, right, mental health and mental well-being, right, and those factors that we just talked about is actually something for everyone.
That's a great point. I would like to dig a little bit deeper and use your expertise as a biochemist. It was in the 90s when I started getting interested in what does it need to stay healthy? So back in the 90s, every time when I talked with my doctor or with other doctors or physicians in Europe, they mostly focused on treating diseases. And most of the questions I had were around, how can I stay healthy? How, what do I have to do to not get sick at all? And I didn't get answers. Where I got answers was in martial arts, but unfortunately, the ways of the martial arts are great. They work, and there are many great masters. For example, in the Shaolin Temple in 2014, I was in the Shaolin Temple, or also in Japan, but it's not very scientifically, or it has not been very scientifically proven. The points they brought up back in the 90s were similar to the points that you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, that in order to stay healthy, people need to sleep, need to exercise, need to take care of their nutrition and also social connection and purpose. Can we talk a little bit further about these four topics, why they are so important from the McKinsey and the biochemist point of view? Let's start with sleep. Why does sleep play such a crucial role in staying healthy?
Yeah, and thank you for the question. It's a wonderful topic, and it's fascinating research behind it from a biochemical, and then also sort of how then the biochemistry of our body then affects our feeling and mental health and well-being. Right. So if we start with sleep, then there is sort of two topics, right? There is the topic of duration, and then there is the topic of do I get the deep sleep, et cetera, right? Why does deep sleep matter? During deep sleep, which is usually the sleep that happens in the first half of the night, right? We sleep in 90 minute cycles. And then in the early 90 minute cycles, then ideally deep sleep takes place, right? This is really where the body restores and where growth hormone is secreted, right? And the key thing is, if there is no deep sleep, then there is the secretion of growth hormone, which is then helping us regenerate, is diminished or let's see, reduced, which then means, right, that sometimes sleep doctors, they deal with people who then say, well, I sleep 9 hours, but I still feel terrible in the morning. I still feel tired in the morning, right? And then when they do the diagnosis, et cetera, then sometimes they find that, yes, this person slept 9 hours, but there were only 5 minutes of deep sleep. And if there's 5 minutes of deep sleep, right, the literature usually talks more about ideally, 90 minutes of deep sleep, right? Then you can imagine, right? If there is only 5 minutes of deep sleep versus 90 minutes of deep sleep, that is then, of course, a reason why people then feel tired in the morning, right? And if that continues over many, many days, weeks, months, and sometimes even years, right, that then has very detrimental effects for the body. But since you started out with mental health, right, this has then also a link towards the mental health and well-being, right? And I think one of the politicians once said that after they had negotiated in Europe, in Brussels, through the whole night, right, they said, well, if I'm massively sleep deprived, right, I'm not a very inspirational person anymore the next day, right? But it pretty much means if we sort of are severely sleep deprived or have these sometimes even medical problems that we don't get enough deep sleep, that then means that, at the end of the day, we are increasing our level of anxiety via bad sleep, right?
That's very interesting. I think it was this week that I read an article about anxiety, and this article stated that 90% of our fears don't come true. So when I listen to you, it now comes together in my mind, like when people don't get enough sleep, they create for themselves a state of anxiety. And if they continue on this path, it might also lead towards depression. And then their thought processes are going in a direction where they definitely don't make sound decisions for themselves. And I just imagine, when they are community leaders or leaders in a company or politicians, as you mentioned, it might also negatively impact the entire society. Is this a statement that you would say is correct, or did I miss something in the explanations?
Well, I would say, of course, then there are those interconnections, right? And the fascinating thing is that from a biochemical perspective, right, there are then also connections from mobility and movement, right? So, and I had that in my life working at a desk and at a country, right? If you do, and again, there is then a body of scientific evidence, right? But some of our coaches that we work with in our health and well-being program, right, he would say, if people walk less than, I think the number he uses is 5,000 steps, right? And he can quote a few scientific publications behind that. if they walk less than 5,000 steps, then again, it is a similar loop than the sleep loop that you just described, right? We then, since we are made to move as an animal, as a being, right, then lack of movement and lack of mobility, and right, and if you do only, I don't know, 2,000 or 3,000 steps a day because you sit in front of the computer or the TV or God knows what, right, that is then also something that increases your anxiety level if that goes on for a while, right? So if we then have a classical modern office worker, right, who might say, oh, you know, sleep is sort of a lower priority, and I sit on the sofa or at the desk the whole day and walking, right, then they increase anxiety by two means, and then anxiety is going up, right? And then if anxiety is going up, that then often has then connections, you know, both to the immune system and to how people then eat, right? And then sometimes they gain weight and that they move even less. So we can quickly get into, you know, what scientists then describe as vicious cycles, right? Where then we are moving on several fronts, sleep, nutrition, mobility, let's say, in the wrong direction from a health and well-being perspective, which then raises anxiety, which then sort of fuels the cycle even more.
5,000 steps are roughly a 5K. So it's a 5K every day, basically, that your source recommends to stay healthy, when I assume that one step is 1 meter.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You love listening to podcasts, but have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? Maybe you want to build a brand, grow your business, or are looking for an excuse to talk about your favorite hobby. Whatever your reason for making a podcast, Buzzsprout is the place to start. Since 2009, Buzzsprout has helped over 300,000 people launch their own podcasts. Buzzsprout walks you step by step through the whole process and will give you powerful tools to start, grow, and monetize your podcast. Ready to get started? Click the link in the show notes to get our free step-by-step guide to starting your podcast today.
Yeah, well, I like to think about it in a different way also, as part of a health and well-being program, right? You know, since many of us spend in the business world, right, spend a lot of time each day in video conferences, right, when, for example, I personally then try to do one video conference in the morning, half an hour, and ideally one video conference in the afternoon, and another half hour on the phone, right, while walking, right? Mm-hmm. Right, because when you say 5K, that sounds like, oh my God, 5K, that is sports, and now I need to put on my trainers. But walking for 30 minutes, during a video conference where maybe you don't need to take notes, et cetera, you have about 4,500 steps.
That's a great idea.
It's pretty simple. And I have people, when we do catch-up calls, we already both know that we should take that catch-up call to do. So then we both go for a walk while we chat with each other. And even in team calls and group calls, and what we've done is then to say, okay, who takes notes this time, right? And all the other people can then walk. And then one person says, and then we rotate it. Anyway, but that's now becoming very practical.
No, that's actually a great idea. Also, there are some literature out there that I think philosophers said that only thoughts that are created during walking are of importance, and you can forget all other thoughts while sitting. So having a walk basically is a great solution. You mentioned a third pillar. So we had exercise. It's important that people stay healthy, and healthy means in a way that they come to the office in a positive mood, optimistic mood, that they engage with people, and they have the mental capacity to drive things forward in the company. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're already in a deep state of depression or already severely ill. You mentioned the third pillar, nutrition. Why is nutrition so important? I mean, I live in Vienna, and I think our national meal is schnitzel with French fries. So what's your opinion on nutrition?
Yeah, and well, nutrition is a wonderful and fascinating topic, right? Because it's both related to health and well-being, right? Mm-hmm. And with well-being, I mean that, you know, ideally it tastes well and it's a great experience and we do social bonding over, right? So nutrition is completely multifaceted, right? And the other fascinating part is, if we quickly go back to the biochemical side, is that nutrition is also very individual, right? There are fascinating studies where nutrition researchers gave 100 people the same to eat, and then they measured the blood glucose response, and they found very different responses from different people to exactly the same food, right? So in that sense, for me, as being a bit of a biohacker, as mentioned, right, for me, it was fascinating to try out different things, right? And the coach that I have been working with, she encouraged me to say, Tobias, Why don't you 2 hours after you've eaten something, why don't you sort of quickly think, do I have now more energy than before? Do I have the same energy and it didn't change? Or do I have less energy and maybe I feel tired, right? And then I came to that conclusion, which, you know, from a scientific perspective, it's not very surprising. So I feel a little bit embarrassed that I didn't realize it earlier. You know, when I love schnitzel as well, Christian. So when I have my Wiener schnitzel with French fries or with pasta or kartoffel salad, potato salad, etc., then I feel really tired in the afternoon. So then I did the experiment of, okay, I still eat my Wiener schnitzel, but I eat it this time with salad or with some vegetables, and I leave out the carbohydrates, right? And again, you know, everyone is a little bit different in terms of nutrition, right? For me, that had the effect that my afternoon tiredness was gone, right?
Really?
And so I still eat what I like to eat, right? But now one of my personal micro habits is that sort of from Monday to Friday, then I try to be a bit good with my nutrition, and I would focus on salads and vegetables as side dishes. I still eat my salmon or my chicken or, you know, whatever as the main, right? But I would try to reduce or get rid of rice, right? And for some of the people who are then more into it, right, that is then doing a bit more of what some people say a ketogenic diet, right, where you try to reduce sugar and carbohydrates and for me that then has just the personal benefit of being less tired during the week. And then Saturday and Sunday are my cheat days, where then I eat lots of chocolate and ice cream and all sorts of other things with my kids and my wife.
Yeah, I was in the Shaolin Temple in 2014, and the abbot there said it's really easy to live a clean life when you are in a monastery. So working out, meditation, and vegetarian lifestyle. But he said it's really tough when you're out there in the world. I mean, just look at Vienna. You mentioned the vicious cycle before. So getting up in the morning, going to a Starbucks, for example, having a cafe latte and with a delicious cake. And then during lunchtime, schnitzel with French fries or with some rice. And to overcome the afternoon tiredness, a can of coffee again. So just push that. Is nutrition really, does it have so heavy impact on health, not only mental health, but health general? I mean, I read an article recently on the internet where I didn't believe it entirely. A writer who promotes also a keto diet, vegan lifestyle, and he mentioned that patients with stage 4 cancer, when they stick to a routine where they got enough sleep, enough exercise and nutrition, showed signs of remission with that. Does it really have such an heavy impact on how we feel and over decades, how illnesses evolve? So nutrition, sleep and exercise.
Well, I think there's lots to unpack now, Christian, right? Maybe if we start with the cancer patient, since I feel very, very close to this kind of topic. But there is a body of scientific evidence, for example, that shows that that cancer patients who have anxiety, depression, right, and of course it's a very natural thing, right, that given the fear and of dying, etc., right, that one gets into that anxiety, depressed state during cancer, right, there is a body of scientific evidence saying that cancer patients who are able to keep a more, let's say, positive state of mind versus the people that go into sort of anxiety and depression during cancer, they have the people with a more positive state of mind have better patient outcomes at the end, right? So in terms of the cancer, right? So does that mean now that I think that is a nice example, and that is also a very proven example of how our mental well-being, right, then has also implications on diseases, etc. Right, you know, the other part is and of course with cancer to finish that topic, right, there is then a genomic component, there is a behavioral component, there is then a, you know, what type of medicines, etc., do you get? There is the mental health component, right? So this is something where, you know, let me put it like that. I'm always get a bit suspicious in such a multifactorial world. If someone says, oh, you just need to do this one thing and then you cure your cancer, right? In many instances, from a biochemical and medical perspective, right? There are several factors that come together, right? And mental health and sleep and nutrition and whether one moves or not, right? These behavioral things, they have an impact not only on your well-being but also on your health, right? And if we maybe for a second example, in addition to the cancer example, switch to chronic diseases, right? Many of the chronic diseases come from our metabolism, you know, be diabetes, hypertension, etc., right? But if I don't sleep well, if I don't walk, if I eat too much food and gain lots of weight, and if I'm not in a positive mental state, right, that is sort of something where we see the diabetes type 2 numbers rising in this world, right, where then people are sort of getting into chronic diseases, into that vicious cycle, which then, you know, the overweight and then the overload of carbohydrates and sugar, right, then diabetes type 2 likelihood increases, right, and on the other type, right, then the impact of having good micro habits there is then also shown, right? So I think that's an important point, right? And the final thing I'll say is that you know, in that respect, why I also find digital health a promising thing, right? Is mm-hmm. digital tools have, right, we've seen with social media and apps and mobile phones, right, that digital tools can help change human behavior quite a bit, right? And I would say not always to the better, quite a lot also to the worse, right? When you spend lots of time in front of screens and you look at other people that are much more beautiful than you yourself, right? And then you get into negative body image, negative mental state, et cetera. But what I'm excited about is using digital tools to help people towards positive sustainable behavior change, right? And that is, since you mentioned prevention earlier, Christian, right, in a world where our health systems are often designed to deal with acute sickness, and so I'm very well treated if I'm run over by a car, right, or if I break my arm, right, then I'm sort of back to normal, right? But that point around, as you said, with the martial arts and medicine, right, the point of getting towards positive behavior change is then a different topic. And there often our health system are less good, right? Because you spend maybe 10 minutes with a doctor per quarter, or if you are a patient or 10 minutes per year, right? And there, of course, then the micro habits are harder to do, right? Because the change is hard, right? And therefore, it is, that's why I'm positively excited about digital tools nudging us sort of towards better micro habits more on a daily basis instead of speaking with a doctor once a year for 10 minutes.
Yeah, it's good that you mentioned that. It reminded me of a conversation I had 20 years ago when I came from a seminar and also proudly presented that you can do a lot, that people can do a lot to stay healthy themselves with micro habits and eating the right nutrition. But 20 years ago, the response was, let's say, mediocre to not very positive. And it's good to hear from you now that the understanding in our society evolved tremendously in the last 20 years towards these micro habits. I think our healthcare system is great when it comes to treating illnesses and sicknesses, and it's really evolved. After 50, I think it's one point in time people have a high chance to get sick. But didn't really know before I started with martial arts that people can do so many things. You mentioned so many things themselves in a daily life to stay healthy longer. You mentioned digital solutions that can help people. Can we dig a little bit deeper into that topic? Which digital solutions do you have in mind that are helpful to create micro habits?
Yeah, and a wonderful question. Maybe just to what you said earlier, right? I would just make a distinction between acute illnesses and chronic illnesses, right? I would say our health systems are good at dealing with acute illnesses, right? Having an infection or having a broken bone, right? They are generally less good in dealing with chronic diseases, right? Like diabetes, cardiovascular diseases, etc. But and then the question becomes, how can we actually better deal with chronic diseases? And that's where often cognitive behavioral therapy comes in, which then, since it's cognitive behavioral therapy and has to do sort of with your practices, right? It's ideally done more often than less often, right? And then we move into now a situation where then digital tools could do three things for, if we assume that I'm a chronic disease patient, right, digital tools can do three things, right? So they make it more convenient for me to manage my chronic disease, you know, online appointment booking, teleconsultations, right? So that that I just have an easier access, a more convenient access to manage my disease. Then there is a second part around sustainable behavior change, right? Most chronic diseases benefit from sustainable behavior change of the patient in terms of better nutrition, better sleep, better stress management, and better mobility, let's say, right? So then the question is, how do we get there, right? So my doctor, he looked at my values. I think it was 2 years ago, right? And then one value was higher in my blood diagnostic, and then he just smiled at me and said, next year you'll need to eat a few cookies less.
Okay.
Did that, you know, was it funny? Yes. Did it help me with sustainable behavior change? No. Mm-hmm. Right? Because, you know, I usually go to the doctor a little bit before Christmas, right? So then he tells me that I should eat less cookies. Well, then Christmas comes, and guess what? That's when I eat the most cookies in the whole year. And then sort of New Year starts, and then that is already 4 weeks back, right? And in my day-to-day life, it just doesn't help me that much if someone has told me sort of what I should do instead of how to do it and how to integrate it into my life, right? And that is sort of one wonderful point that health coach told me, right? You have all of those things that you know, right? And you have all of those things that you could do, and then life gets in the way, right?
I couldn't agree more.
Right? And then sort of the question is, how can we actually use digital health to sustainable behavior change, right? And that is then nudging, personalization, gamification, having stuff on the phone being prompted, and then also having tools and cognitive behavioral therapy is shown to do that and can be delivered by digital tools, right, to get into a more positive frame of mind, et cetera. Right? And the third part, why I am quite positive and excited that digital tools have the potential to help chronic disease patients is they can also make it more fun to improve health and well-being, right? Because if I'm a chronic disease patient, That's hard enough, right? But do I constantly want to remind it that I'm a, right? So in that sense, there is that fun component that we see with social media and various apps, right? Where people actually willingly spend time watching videos and posting stuff and reading what other people have posted, right? So in that sense, make it, right? So health, that is sort of one of the things I would love to sort of contribute to over the next decades, right? Making health and well-being less of a sort of dry and hard and topic, but more of a fun topic.
Let's stay a little bit with this digital health and what you would like to do in the future. And maybe I can add one story from my life. When I think about solutions in the healthcare system, the first thing that pops up in my mind is drug development. And it's complicated development processes that take years or decades. Just imagine BioNTech, for example, when they started with their mRNA technology. I think the company started somewhere in 2008, but the scientific roots go back to the 60s. When we talk about lifestyle change and chronic diseases, what helped me in the last years were simple apps. In 2010, I wanted to run a marathon and was looking for a solution to measure my distance. And what I found was Runkeeper in the United States. And I think a year later, Runtastic started in Austria. And it was really helpful to measure distance. I mean, the technology was not as advanced as it is now today, but it worked basically. And one day I forgot to uncheck that my progress is shared on Facebook. And then a couple of weeks later, I found out that every run that I did went directly to Facebook. Yeah. And the response was quite interesting. Instead of being offended or getting a lot of hate mails or something, people were really motivating. They admired me, that I get up every day, that I do my runs, the distance I covered, and they sent positive messages. And this helped me to train for my first marathon in my life and move forward with that. And I think this is the positive side of digital solutions. Now I have these two worlds in my mind. So these easy, small solutions that I would not really consider therapeutics or therapeutical solutions. And then from my professional life, I know these scientific sound solutions like mRNA technology that really help people, but cost a lot of money. The digital health solutions that you have in mind, are they more on the side of the hardcore pharma industry with long development cycles? Or would you also consider these small lifestyle apps that don't really look like much is going on? Are they also helpful in your opinion?
What we've seen over the last few years is that those individual apps and software pieces, right, that they have been merging into broader digital health sort of multi-service offerings, you know, that we could call digital health ecosystems, right, where at the end of the day we are now then moving towards a situation where we have several service offerings that help me along my customer journey or patient journey or citizen journey to better health and well-being and make it as convenient as possible. So for example, that could start if we again take an example me being, let's say, a chronic disease patient, right? So the first part of the ecosystem could be a sort of symptom checker or medication management app that helps me manage my disease. And when I feel bad or when something feels wrong, right, I can sort of engage with a very low barrier of this, right? And then that gives me the first indication of what might be going on. Then I could move on to an online appointment booking a piece in the same digital health ecosystem to then schedule a virtual consultation with maybe Dr. Christian on a video call, right? And I'm still in my home and it's still just 10 minutes after I had the problem, right? And then I'm speaking with the doctor and then maybe we find out that that there is something, let's say, more serious, et cetera. And then we can move towards disease management programs that have been developed for chronic disease patients, where I would then maybe as a chronic disease patient go through a structured guided program towards better habits and moving and dealing with my disease better. And often this is then accompanied with medication as well, right? So that ultimately medication and digital tools come together in an integrated treatment path. And other parts are patient remote monitoring, which is a whole body of scientific evidence around it, where then Dr. Christian automatically gets my values of blood glucose, for example, or blood pressure, etc., once a day or once a week or three times a day, etc. And like that, right, we have a much closer bond than me showing up at your doorstep of the doctor's office once a month or once a quarter, right? Because then you see my curves and how things are developing. And if you see that my weight curve is sort of steadily increasing week by week, or if you see that my blood pressure is steadily increasing, or if you see that my blood glucose level are going in the wrong direction, right? Then you can coach me, right? And we can just intervene earlier, right? And with chronic disease patients, get people more back onto the right track earlier rather than later, right? And if I can share one example, even with an acute disease like COVID-19, right, there's been a fascinating a project with the University Clinic of Heidelberg during COVID. They asked patients who tested positive, would you like to be part of a patient remote monitoring program, which means that you will get a blood oximeter, right, to measure the oxygen saturation at the fingertip and submit your body temperature and how difficult you find it breathing several times a day, right? And then the idea was that they pretty much offer patients like that, that a doctor can pretty much watch over their shoulder and sort of follow them as they now isolate at home. And, you know, most of them at the time went to COVID for the first time, right? And the question then becomes, will it be mild or will I have complications? So the idea was then with that remote monitoring program that the patient submits measurements three times a day, and then the doctor would within 2 or 3 hours be able to spot that now complications have started, right? But first of all, the question is, will there be complications? And then usually complications with COVID, right, when we look at the curves, usually start on day 7 or on day 8 or on day 9, 10, 11 or 12, right? And they recently published the results. So spotting complications within 2 or 3 hours for patients in that program, and then intervening early with often, you know, medication or sometimes hospitalization, reduced the mortality of that cohort of patients by a factor of threefold to fourfold compared to the other municipalities around Heidelberg.
That's amazing.
Right? And that is for me one of the most powerful examples how pretty simple digital tools can actually have an impact, right? Because with acute diseases like COVID, it allows you to intervene much earlier than having the patient sit at home and wondering whether they have complications and often coming 2, 3, 4 days too late to the hospital by themselves, right? And even with chronic diseases, right, you sort of get then coached earlier and sort of put back at, on a more positive track than on the track that you might be on.
Do you like this episode? Then please, please subscribe to the channel to get a notification whenever I publish a new one. That are amazing points. I mean, acute diseases, I also think about the single households where people often have the problem that when patients who are at risk for a heart attack, for example, or for a stroke, when they are singles, nobody watches them. But with modern technology, when I understand you right, you can also monitor them. And if there is a serious episode, we have the potential, theoretically, to fix that in future. Then the second part you mentioned is chronic diseases, where digital solutions act more like coaching, in-time coaching, helping people to stay on track with lifestyle changes. What about the healthy population? I mean, sometimes I'm now close to 50, I'm 48, and I wish, so my biggest regret is I wish I have known what I know now 30 years ago. So especially when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to nutrition, and have a coach who say, don't eat the cake, don't go to the party. And if you go to the party, don't stay until 4 a.m. in the morning. Would it make sense to also consider such digital solutions to use to bring more healthcare information to people to educate them earlier in life?
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree, right? You know, being here in Germany and Berlin, right, I've got the feeling that every German knows more about how their car works than how their body works, right? Which is a fascinating situation. But joking aside, you know, in the last WHO country comparative study, right, a country like Germany in terms of health competency was right at the bottom, right? So I think it was like 58% of the people in the survey had low health competency, right? Which then means that they might take choices that seem maybe logical or maybe to do, but then they have a certain medium term to long term effect, right? So I think there again, my conviction is that we need to make it fun, right? Because if we print brochures that sit somewhere in libraries and you know, and they tell you what are the 37 things that you shouldn't do, right? 36 out of those 37 things are fun to do, right? Mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty foreseeable, right? And we've had that over the last decades, right? That it doesn't have sort of a big impact, right? So I think there is a big part about health competencies and digital health competencies that that actually can be fun and actually can help people feel better and be better, right? But it doesn't have to be that you now suddenly live a little bit like a monk and don't do anything that is sort of your normal daily routine, right? So the you know, that would be for me one part, right? That people know more what drives their health and well-being, right? I didn't know that it was the pasta at lunchtime for many years, despite it, you know, maybe I should have known as a biochemist, but you know, and then I just leave out the pasta at lunch. So then it's a very simple decision that is a personal decision. Does pasta at lunch bring me more joy? Or does being less tired in the afternoon makes me happier? Right. And then I can take the informed decision that for me personally, right, I'm happy to get rid of the pasta at lunch and I prefer to be alert and full of energy and not tired for 3 hours in the afternoon. Right? But there might be people who love pasta who say, I love pasta. And I think for me, the important point is that people know what the implications are, right? And often there are certain behavioral patterns where then there are detrimental consequences and the implications are not clear, right? I think the other part, just quickly, is that you know, in our health and well-being program, right? First of all, we think about what is sort of the purpose and the aspiration and the motivation, right? This is not about senseless self-optimization just because we can, right? Why do I want to do that, right? You mentioned, right, you are 48 and you still look much younger, right? But you have a certain purpose and motivation behind it, that you like to maybe increase your health and you like to maybe increase your well-being, right? So I think there is one component around what is my underlying purpose or motivation and what is really important for me, right? And I think then based on that, right, then there is a bit what you said, the health competency can then help. And then ultimately you can get to a few micro habits that move you then in the right direction. And that's our experience having done that program for many years. It's about small micro habits that you can integrate into your daily life instead of the radical changes. And then it's also about not beating yourself up that you need to now do this 100% of the time, all the time, perfect, right? But it's more like a a sort of 80% mindset. If I do my micro habit 80% of the time, that's totally fine. And I don't, and especially I don't need to get stressed about it for the 20% where I don't do it. So Saturday and Sunday can be cheat days where you do all of the things that you crave and might not be that, right? But if you are really good from Monday to Friday, why not? And so in the end of the day, it's a personal decision what is important to people.
Yeah, I completely agree to what you say. I think it's necessary also for social and mental health. Just imagine, I mean, when you go to a pastry shop with your friends and you start then lecturing them about the healthy lifestyle and why this is bad for them. So having a cake is a good thing sometimes. When I think back, one of the questions I had to one of my martial arts trainers was, it's karate kid, there's a sensei, what can I do to stay healthy? Mm-hmm. And his response was very surprising to me. So I expected a long lecture and a list of 100,000 things that I need to do. And the only things he said was drink water, green tea, sleep more, and eat your vegetables. That's it. So I said, okay, is it really that simple? And I used the opportunity in 2008 between two jobs to take a few weeks off and really try this lifestyle. And wake up early in the morning, meditate, go for walks, eat only vegetables, water, and green tea, and read motivating books for a couple of weeks. And the difference was really huge. And I wasn't aware until the point in time I did these weeks of reducing my life to what's necessary and leaving out everything else. It wasn't until that moment that I realized what a difference it is. The question I have to you now is, I mean, taking a few weeks off, I think people have children, have families, have jobs, have their responsibilities, is almost next to impossible for the entire society. How would you tackle the problem of bringing health education to people on a systemic level? What's the solutions McKinsey is working on in that area? What's your recommendation?
Yeah. Well, what we do and what we are building out is to do this on several levels, right? And to integrate that also into the daily lives of colleagues and people, right? But of course, first of all, this is sort of voluntary, right? This is for people who actually want to improve something, right? And interestingly, right, there are then different groups of people, right, that I've been dealing with. There are some people who are in the segment of saying, oh, you know, maybe I've gained weight and I have the feeling that I now should do something to improve my health, right? That is sort of the health-driven segment, you could say, of people. And then there is a segment of people you know, that's sort of many of the biohackers, right? They would then say, oh, you know, if I optimize sleep, nutrition, fitness, stress management, then I'm more productive and et cetera, right? That is, of course, a typical segment that we see everywhere in sort of the health and well-being a community. Then there is the segment of people saying, well, actually, I'm medically healthy and I feel I'm productive enough, but I just want to feel better. I'm personally in that segment, right? And then there is a segment of people who say, oh, you know, I've tried this and I've tried that and I've tried this diet and nothing has worked and I find this really hard, right? So there is already this is the simplified version, right? So it needs to be it needs to take people where they are from based on that motivation or that need or that desire or aspiration that they have instead of doing one size fits all stuff, right? The second experience that we've made with our programs is that it needs to be integrated into the daily life of people. It needs to be impactful. It needs to be fun. And if you don't integrate it well in the daily lives of people, and if it's not fun, and of course impact needs to be there, otherwise people wouldn't do it, right? Then so there is then a very question, sort of, how do you design it to achieve those objectives, right? Because if you give me a 200-page book and say everything is in there, now you just need to read it and you do it, right? Not a lot will usually happen, right? So there we design the programs and we work with coaches that then do this in bite-sized manners, that some as videos, some as reading, some as nudges, etc. So there we offer those programs, several month programs for people that they then can work. And this is then hybrid programs, right, with a coach plus digital tools that work very well. We also have some programs that are digital only. And then the third part is that we found is important is to do it also on a team level, right? So that it's not just like Christian going through his 6-month program, right? But you might be working in a team with 3 or 4 other people, right? And then this is then less about health and well-being. This is then the framing is often then more around way of working, way of collaboration, right? And then, right, and if we then just, you know, play through hypothetically, right, if we are now in a team and we will be working together over the next 12 weeks on a project, right, sort of what would we like? Do we want to work like crazy and are 12 weeks of sleep deprived, right? Or do we might want to integrate our fitness routines into now the 12 weeks so that if I know that you like to go running on a Tuesday evening, then maybe I cover on Tuesday evening so that you can do your run. And maybe I like to do swimming on a Thursday morning, and then maybe you cover on Thursday morning so that I can go swimming. But so then we elevate this from individual norms and agreements to actually team agreements. Right. And some of those agreements, right, some teams then have a lot of energy around, you know, having better nutrition together because they all like to eat and they really like that. Right. And some people are like, okay, I would like to optimize sleep. And therefore we get to a few agreements, how we help each other on that. Right. And then we get to also the situation that you described with your social media profile, right, that then actually people help each other achieve that and spur each other on, right? So in that sense, that is another experience that we've made, that it's sort of both, ideally it's the individual level and the team level.
I completely agree. I mean, it's extremely helpful for me when I post a picture from a run for my documentation, and then friends encourage me to do more of it and congratulate for the effort. It's really motivating. So it's great to hear that also your company integrates that into the daily life. Also managing expectations, I think, is very important, that people can speak openly about their wishes and desires, and that the colleagues also support them, that to some extent they are integrated in the work life. This is really great development.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, people just generally like it, right? And also, you know, if we think about it from also from a work perspective, right? If you sleep well and if you are able to integrate your fitness into your work life, right? You are just more a more creative, a more inspirational, a more happy person, right? So if we take my own journey, right? I started sort of with this whole biohacking stuff about 8 years ago, right? I've lost more than 10 kilos, right? I now do more 12,000 steps a day than 4,000 steps a day. I now sleep on average more than 7 hours, right? And I'm about 3 times as happy as I was 10 years ago, right? And a lot of that is then, you know, it's then fun when you are on that journey. and then you get into a positive cycle, right? Because when you feel it and you feel more positive, then it's easier to continue on the path.
Let me ask you one question to what you just said. I mean, it was 2002 or 2003 where I had this attitude that I want to focus on training because I realized that it makes me happier. And I also thought that when I'm happier, I come to the office with a positive attitude, with a positive mood, and make more compliments. And that also has then an impact on the people in the office. Leaving the office, however, at 6 p.m. in the evening when all colleagues were working until 8 p.m. in the evening, and then went to the next pub for a drink and then went home about 11 p.m. and came back 7 a.m. in the morning, was a little bit tense. So we had a discussion, and I also made the statement and say, look, when I do more exercise, my mood is better, I'm happier, and I'm more productive. And then came those finance guys who said, well, can you measure it? How can you measure that? We can measure the time that you spend in the office, but not how happiness impacts the productivity in a company. Are you aware of any measurement tools for CEOs when they want to implement such measures that they also can then demonstrate to the owners or to the employees the difference it makes?
Yeah. So there are various tools and also that can be used on company levels, and then designing health and well-being programs on company level that are then, you know, fact-based, and, you know, depending on how much fact-based or metrics also the company wants, right? Then you can do that. You can do that on the one hand with surveys and also then with some of the metrics that you want to measure, right? But you know, if we and again, many companies like to do that. But if we just go back to the basics and look at the scientific that scientific literature, just picking again the sleep example, and there is a whole body of evidence where they show that they have a cohort one sleeps, I think, 7 hours or 8 hours. Cohort two sleeps 6 hours. Cohort three sleeps 5 hours for several days, and they get cognitive tests to do. But this has been shown years and years ago that the cohort that sleeps 5 hours a night will, depending on what study you read, their productivity the next day is 60% or 70% of the productivity of the cohort that sleeps 7 or 8 hours, right?
That's a huge difference.
So yes, of course, you can now develop and design dashboards and think about how you now measure that exactly. Christian is now also having that effect, right? But on the other hand, right, it's there are just a few fundamentals, right? Because you are a human being that has a human biochemistry, and therefore, right, do I now need to know whether your productivity was 64% or 66% after you slept only 5 hours in your case? But so in that sense, I'm not saying anything against that, right? I think that the important bit here is that And that's also an important framing, how we frame our health and well-being program, right? That it helps people be at your best. And yes, it if done well, it of course has massive positive benefits on a company level as well, in terms of, you know, how creative people are, the problem-solving capacity, the productivity, et cetera, right? But this is actually something where framing it more from a, you know, helping people be at their best kind of perspective, instead of, oh, we have now, I don't know, 17 levers to increase productivity by 7% kind of thing, right? That is sort of often not the smartest way to design it.
Great words. I completely agree to what you say. When people exercise regularly, get enough sleep, it makes a huge difference. For example, focus, just picking the right point to work on that drives the company forward. I mean, it comes much easier with enough sleep and the right nutrition and enough exercise or meditation also.
Yeah. And sorry, Chris, just one other thought, right? We also looked into that extensively on country level, right? So for example, if we take Europe as an example, right? Before the pandemic, the cost for the European society and economy, right? The cost of a poor health was about 2.7 trillion dollars per year, right? So about 15% of GDP in Europe was the cost of poor health and lost economic opportunity. So that's equivalent to about $5,000 per person if we break that down, right? So then the question is sort of, what are the drivers of these poor health costs, right? And then musculoskeletal disorders, so that would mean lower back pain, neck pain, they account for 24% of the total economic loss from poor health overall. And then the mental health disorders with which we started our conversation, such as depression, anxiety, they account for 18%. And neurological disorders such as migraine, headache, etc., they account for 13%. Right? And now we come back to what we can do. If we would apply in a more consistent way the different health and medical tools that are at our disposal in our societies, right, in a more consistent way, we could reduce that health burden without any innovation that is in the pipelines of companies. We could reduce the health burden by about 30% in Europe over the next 2 decades, just with a more timely and consistent application of the interventions that are available today. And what does that mean, since you mentioned your age? That would mean, from a society perspective, that an average 65-year-old person in Europe in the year 2040 would be as healthy as a 55-year-old today. Right? And if you do the full health economic calculation, it would also mean 11 million more people would be alive in Europe by the year 2040. Right? And then, and this is now, if we talk briefly from a health system and country perspective, the most positive message is that two-thirds of the improvement opportunity really lies in the areas of health promotion, prevention, health literacy, and healthier environments, right? And then the question is, so what would be the benefit and the impact and the business case if we did that as a European society or sort of a European set of countries, right? And if we would go in that direction, that would mean that this would contribute $2.4 trillion to Europeans' GDP by 2040. So that would be a sort of a 10% boost above projections. Or you could also say, if, you know, in GDP is more the annual, that it could be 1.5 percentage points of annual growth for Europe. So that's a big deal, right? Because that pretty much is the size of the demographic issues that we have, right? So this would be almost a positive magnitude to counter the negative impact of the demographic problems that we have ongoing in Europe, right? And then the other part is then often, right, often we have the mindset in European countries, our health system, they are very expensive, right? And we in Germany, we spend more than 300 billion euros a year on our healthcare system. And in many European countries, and I guess in many countries across the world, right, then there is a notion we need to keep our healthcare spending under control. Right? That is sort of a mindset that has been there for decades, right? Which means that we treat healthcare and health as a well-being as a cost bucket that needs to be controlled and managed down. And what I find fascinating and why I'm fascinated working in health and well-being is that actually, what if we would treat health and well-being as a positive investment case on our country level or on our company level, right? And on the country level, we've done the research, our economics unit has done the research, depending on what country you are in and what your starting position is across the world, you get either $2 back for each dollar that you invest strategically in health and well-being on a country level, or up to $4, right? So on average, I think it's 2.7 or so if we look at it across countries, right? So you get $2.7 back for every $1 that a country would strategically invest in health and well-being on a sort of health promotion, prevention type topic. And I think that is a very promising and a very positive message to sort of move in that direction, in my opinion.
That are excellent points. Thank you. Thank you for making them at the podcast. I always lacked the data. And also, I completely agree to what you say. Seeing health as an investment is a great shift in mindset. I also think that, for example, when we look at viral diseases, I think when the population is healthier, the risk of getting a severe disease, a severe outcome, is less than when people have less health on a population level. Is this a study that you cited that it's publicly available? If yes, it would be great if you could add it to the podcast, to the description with a link to the study. One question popped up while you were speaking. You mentioned some players are on the market already. So we have politicians who direct tax money into the system and make sure that it's used properly for society. Then we have the large corporations. We were talking about pharma. Then we have the new startup ecosystem that gained popularity in my eyes since 2014-15 in Europe. Mm-hmm. And then we have the individuals and the families. What are the roles of these different players when we just make a mind game and say, let's assume we go together on this journey and want to change the European society in the direction you proposed a couple of minutes ago? What roles do you see for the different players in this system?
A fascinating question and also complex question, right? Because we are living in a multifactorial world, right? And health and well-being is impacted by many many different things, right? So if we maybe for a moment zoom into digital health, right? That we don't have the full health system, right? So digital health is pretty much a set of 25 different categories or offerings, right? And about 10 of them usually are citizen facing, right? Online appointment booking, teleconsultation, diagnostics at home, online delivery of medications, and so on. And then a bit more than 10 are not citizen facing, right? That's sort of clinical decision support systems for doctors and nurses and workflow automation, et cetera. And then on a country level, there are two foundational elements. There is the electronic patient record that is then being used or not used in that country, as well as the e-prescription, right? And often when we look at countries' health system, often these two foundational elements, the e-prescription and the electronic patient record, they are often sometimes even run by a public sector agencies, we could say, or at least there is a very clear set of regulations and standards around it, right? Because in a platform economy and digital economy, right, if everyone has a different app, right, it's slightly less powerful than if everyone has the same app or the same app on the same standards, right? And of course, that is important when you do e-prescriptions and electronic patient records, right? If you go to the doctor and I go to the doctor, that our electronic patient records are following the same logic in a country and that it's ideally linked with our health insurances, et cetera. Right? So there is a role that then the public sector plays and in that regulation, right? But if we take the US as an example, right, which is also a very multidimensional example because they have very high healthcare costs, right? But they are also doing an interesting initiative by moving towards value-based healthcare. Mm-hmm. Right. And they try to manage it in a sort of, you know, we could almost say a two-track process, right? They've got sort of their classical fee-for-service health system, and then they are shifting towards value-based care contracts, right? And every year, over the past few years already, and it's projected to grow by more than 10% over the coming 5 years, every year they have a slightly higher or slightly 10% more patients under value-based care contracts. And these value-based care contracts mean that it's sort of capitated models, right, where then the person leading that program, right, they get a capitated payment, and then they manage that program. And the idea and the hope is that this is better suited to manage people with chronic conditions, right? Because then there is one actor who then designs the overarching program, and that is then usually a hybrid program, sometimes partly digital, partly in person, etc. And that is, I think, a nice way to also affect change, right, from a conceptual level, right? Because if we now say we have a health system that is the way it is, right, and has evolved over 100 years, right, it's very hard to shift that from one year to another, from, you know, fee-for-service healthcare to maybe value-based healthcare, right? And I think it's pretty accepted globally that value-based care is something that has promise, right? And then the question is how to do that change, right? So that is sort of a bit like the framing, right? Do we, if we take Europe as an example, or European countries, right, do we actually want to go to that change? And then do we find mechanisms, right, to actually gradually shift in that direction, right? It's a little bit like the energy and sustainability, right? We try to phase out certain energies, and we try to increase certain energies, and you have sort of the general framework that sort of provides incentives and budgets to have a few things increase and a few other things that we maybe think will serve us less well for the future to decrease. And then the other part is, right, the broader digital health ecosystem. What are those offerings and how are those multi-service offerings being integrated? And there, when we've studied digital health ecosystems across the world, right, and in Asia, they are scaled much higher degree, right, the factor behind the success of Asian digital health ecosystems, right, we look at some ecosystems, they are having more than 400 million citizens in it. The three key success factors are convenience, convenience, and convenience, right? To make it the citizens as easy as possible to look after their health and well-being.
Yeah, I agree. Asia, always when I travel to Asia, I mean, they were, it looked like they're living in the future. So it's from the European standpoint. Korea, South Korea, I mean, automated temperature measurement when you go into elevator. So the elevator doesn't open and tells you, you are sick, please go home. So it would be also very convenient, in my opinion, here in Europe to have such a level of support. Or in 2017, I think it was also in South Korea, we traveled to a hospital that was fully automated. It was really interesting to see that the patient came into the hospital just in time. The entire logistics was organized automatically. There was no waiting time for the patient. A cab picked him up, brought him to the hospital. The doctor was waiting. The team was prepared. He went through the procedure and then could go home. Was the upside. The downside was, of course, I mean, he got barcodes so that they can track like a logistics chain. There's a lot of possibility. One thing that I find particularly difficult, especially for startups that want to help in that space, is to connect to the right people. You also mentioned that the system has its specialities. It's different in each country. I know that you run a lot of initiatives in that area and are one of the super connectors on LinkedIn and in the European society. Can we talk a little bit about your initiatives that you brought to life to move the healthcare system forward and how people can connect to you?
Yes, very, very happy to, Christian. Right, I think, you know, ultimately, I've dedicated the second half of my career to health and well-being and to improving health and well-being in the world. Right? And when I spoke with innovators and health tech CEOs and founders a few years ago, right, and then they said that they would find it helpful to have an informal community on CEO founder level to sort of exchange what life really is like, right? Because often we have pitch events with the innovators, right? And they are very competitive, and there are prizes, and innovator tries to pitch that they are the best, right? So we started what we call the Health Tech Network. As a very different, informal, friendly health tech CEO community. And to be honest, we didn't really think about it that much. We set it up as a global network right from the beginning, right? And it turns out that those two factors have resonated with the health tech CEOs and founders, a friendly CEO community and a global network, because the Europeans are interested in US and Asia and vice versa. So that health tech network grew to a bit more than 1,500 health tech CEOs globally across 25 regional chapters from Canada to Australia. And then there were several hundred health tech CEOs and founders in that community, then lots of other leaders that are working in the health tech space also got interested in that. And with that, I mean, leaders of pharma companies, of medtech companies, of hospitals, of health insurances, of some public sector agencies, investors, etc. Right, and now there's actually a second sort of community we could say that we call the Friends of the Health Tech Network. Right, so in total, this is now two communities: 1,500 health tech CEOs and 500 friends of the network that all like that community on the one hand, right? And I would say one reason why they like that community is that many have the aspiration of improving health and well-being in the world, right? And they increasingly see that it's not only helpful, but it's also fun to do it in a bit of a community instead of everyone trying to do things on their own.
That's great news. What's the best way to get in touch with these communities?
Well, I think the easiest would be to connect via LinkedIn. There is more information on my profile, including sign up link. I'm very passionate about this topic, very happy if people connect with me and on LinkedIn or Twitter, and then we take it from there.
The problem that I have with complex topics is that I'm curious, so we could go on with this conversation for another 5 hours, I guess. And you mentioned already a couple of times that these topics are very complex. So it opens the space for me to ask a lot of questions. Is there anything at the end of the episode, in the end of the recording, is there anything that you would like to say in this episode that I didn't ask in the last 1.5 hours? Is there anything that I missed that you think is important to mention?
Well, I think I think there is, if we look at the big picture, right? At the end of the day, we have health systems today, right? And the question is, how do we want to have healthcare, and how do we want to improve health and well-being in 2030 and 2040, right? So I think we have here a massive opportunity, where we have our traditional medical interventions, medications, medical devices, right? We now have about 25 digital health solutions at our disposal. We have the whole prevention topics, right, that we talked at length about: sleep, nutrition, fitness, stress management. And we didn't talk about that at all. We have genomics and precision medicine as well, right?
What's wrong?
If I have cancer, right, then we could see what is the mutation, and then we look at, can I actually have medication that is personalized to my mutation, right, instead of saying, oh, Tobias has, I don't know, prostate cancer, and we just do the standard prostate cancer treatment that we've done with 10,000 other people, and we hope the best, right? So in essence, we have now the opportunity to rethink how we want to do health and well-being, bringing those four puzzle pieces together, right? The classical interventions, the 25 digital categories, the preventative type stuff, which we talked about, and precision medicine. And I'm very hopeful that this actually has then a dual effect, right? It increases health and well-being of us as citizens, right? It makes our health systems future-proof and maybe even fun. And it even has positive economic benefit.
No, I completely agree to what you say. What role, one question I would like to ask, you mentioned precision medicine. What role does it play in your opinion? why is it so important? There's this term on the internet, genomics revolution, for example. What's the novelty of this area?
Well, it allows personalized medicine, right? So that we don't have one size fits all medicine, right? So if we for example take Germany as an example, we have 500,000 new cancer diagnoses per year, and we have about 35,000 parents who will have a baby with an unclear, unknown, potentially rare disease situation, right? And of course, then the people with cancer, right, that triggers the whole anxiety and all of that. And there, genomics can then help to understand what is that cancer in detail and what is the most promising way of treatment, right? Do we have medication that goes against that mutation that the patient has, or is radiology or something else the most promising path forward, right? And then, of course, with the parents with babies with potentially rare diseases, right? Day to day in a non-genomic world, right? And there are studies about it, on average, this diagnostic journey takes 7 years, right? And it triggers an enormous amount of pain, anxiety, and suffering for those patients and parents and families to go through that. And then maybe finding out 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, 8 years, right? On average, 7 years after birth, what's wrong with the child, right? So I think even if we take those two citizen segments, right, there is a case, and then, you know, Denmark went in that direction with their National Genome Center, right? They designed the National Genome Center to provide these precision medicine services to the Danish citizens at scale on national level, right? Having especially those two customer segments in mind, or citizen segments in mind that I just mentioned.
Yeah, I agree to everything you say. I think the human society can achieve so much when people work together. And as you mentioned, there are so many great developments that started a few years ago and now come to fruition. We just need to pick it up and move it forward together and can create, a great society in future in 10, 20, 30 years. Tobias, thank you very much for this amazing conversation. I really enjoyed getting so much new information from you that I wasn't aware before. It would be really great to stay in touch. And if you want to share future studies, future information on the podcast, feel free to reach out.
Wonderful. Thank you for the invitation. Thanks for having me, Christian.
Have a great weekend. Bye.
Same for you. Bye-bye.
Do you like this episode? Then please, please subscribe to the channel to get a notification whenever I publish a new one. Have a great week.